stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The boxing world mourns today as American fighting legend Muhammad Ali has died after battling Parkinson's disease for more than three decades. Ali was known for his bold language and self-promotion while he was actively boxing. He spoke with reporters before fighting world heavyweight champion Joe Frazier in 1971.
Joe's gonna come out smoking, and I ain't gonna be joking. I'll be pecking and a-poking, pouring water on his smoking. Then this might shock and amaze you, but I will destroy Joe Frazier.
He was both beloved and controversial, and so dominated professional boxing that Sports Illustrated magazine named him Sportsman of the 20th Century. David Miller is a sports writer.
We need a reacquaintance with Muhammad Ali. You're right. He's absolutely the dominant athlete of the 20th century, of our lifetimes, of numerous generations, arguably maybe even the most important public figure of the second half of the 20th century.
Muhammad Ali died in Phoenix, Arizona, in the southwest state of Arizona, where he was being treated for a respiratory ailment at age 74. China could end up erecting a wall of self-isolation if it continues with provocation and militarization of disputed islets in the South China Sea, according to U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter. Carter told Asian defense ministers, security analysts, and scholars at a forum in Singapore there's growing anxiety about Chinese actions in the area.
China's actions in the South China Sea are isolating it at a time when the entire region is coming together and networking. Unfortunately, if these actions continue, China could end up erecting a great wall of self-isolation.
This is VOA News. Pope Francis has decreed Roman Catholic bishops can be removed from office if they're found negligent in dealing with priests accused of abusing children. A new Vatican law the Pope issued today appears to be a response to a long-standing demand by U.S. activists who have denounced what they saw as the Church's failure to take action against pedophile priests. Secretary of State John Kerry and French Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault held talks today to discuss specific challenges facing a proposed Israeli-Palestinian peace conference France would like to host. Mr. Kerry says both Israeli and Palestinians need to take immediate steps to demonstrate their interest in a lasting peace. David Keyes is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's spokesman.
Peace is not going to come through imposition. It's not going to come through a massive global conference with dozens of foreign ministers coming throughout the world. It's going to come when the Palestinian president agrees to actually sit down across the table from the Israeli Prime Minister, and every issue is going to be on the table.
Neither Israel nor the Palestinians attended a Friday meeting in Paris as ministers from 20 countries discussed France's plans for seeking peace between Israel and the Palestinians. The UN Security Council has held an emergency closed-door meeting to hear briefings about the blocking of humanitarian aid in Syria. Syria's UN ambassador, Bashar Jafari, dismissed complaints that his government is hindering deliveries to certain areas. The International Football Governing Body says the group's former president, Sepp Blatter, and two other officials awarded themselves pay raises and bonuses worth $80 million over 5 years. Details of FIFA's internal investigation were released Friday, one day after police raided FIFA's Zurich headquarters to seize evidence for the Swiss investigation. Australia has its first indigenous superhero, Clever Man, a fantasy drama set in a near future Australia, premiered this week on Australian television and blends Aboriginal mythology with superhuman style and political commentary. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The international community has accused us of violating human rights. But these creatures are not human.
The hairy people are a mythological species struggling to coexist alongside humans. The writers of Clever Man have drawn on the deepest legends and traditions of Aboriginal Australia. Its main character is Cohen, a young Indigenous man who inherits superhuman powers and fights against terrifying enemies, humans and otherworldly spirits. Running through this six-part drama are themes of exclusion, discrimination and identity, real-life issues that lie at the heart of modern Indigenous Australia. Aborigines make up about 3% of the Australian population, but their representation on mainstream television has been limited. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Within the sub-region will dominate the agenda here in Dakar, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Ivory Coast, where they also began the terrorist attack.
West African regional leaders meet at a summit in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, Saturday.
The lady was recently appointed by his father as a person who will be restructuring the oil company.
Angolan main opposition party UNITA condemns President José Eduardo dos Santos for appointing his daughter as the new head of the state oil company, Sonangol.
Oh, people of Cameroon, know that a man can't be a Muslim without rebelling against democracy. Your troops are nothing.
And Cameroonian Muslim authorities flesh out strategies to shake off stigmatization and Islamophobia. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A summit of regional heads of state is underway in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, Saturday. Senegalese President Macky Sall, who is the current chairman of the Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS, hosts the summit. For more, I reach Alpha Jallou, an independent journalist in Dakar.
Terrorism and Islamic extremism within the sub-region will dominate the agenda here in Dakar. As you may be well aware that three members of the sub-regional bloc, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Ivory Coast, where they also suffered the terrorist attack in recent months. So this will be also terrorism and Islamic extremism. The information we are getting that will certainly dominate the discussions in Dakar here.
Are there any reasons to believe that these heads of state will come out with strong security policy positions to combat this threat of terrorism in West Africa?
Yes, according to the information filtering here on the ground, they said that they are all determined. Although you know that, I mean, the sub-regional bloc is composed of about 16 countries, although we have noticed some absentees, like about five countries which have not attended, including the Gambia, which is very close to Senegal. But then the information we are getting that they are all determined to come out with a declaration about, I mean, how to combat terrorism. They want to be united in this so that they will try to combat terrorism together. This they will do. Another important point which has just been informed to me among the agendas will also be about, I mean, the regional trade. You know, this has been having some problem. As you know, Gambia and Senegal, they are very close. They are neighbors, but for about 3 months, they had about 3 months long border impasse. And the Gambia was very upset about this, and they resorted taking the matter to the ECOWAS Court of Arbitration. So these are two key important areas that they will look into, and they would want to come out at the end of the day to come out with a very strong commitment of how to resolve these problems.
You have Boko Haram causing trouble in Nigeria. They had cross-border attacks in some part of Niger and Chad. What do you think these people are going to do in terms of ensuring regional commitment to fight and defeat terrorism in West Africa once and for all?
I think what they can do together is just to find a common ground and united in their strive to defeat terrorism. Because terrorism right now, as you know, and Islamic extremism has completely ravaged, I mean, part of the sub-regional member states here. If we can go back to the three terrorist attacks, Mali, Burkina Faso, and the Ivory Coast, And Senegal is also a target. That's why the security here today, wherever you go here, the security is so tight. So I think the only thing they can do is when they can discuss together to see how they can, you know, united, have a common ground, and see that they will all come together, try to fight against this menace.
West African leaders have always talked about regional integration. They even considered having a regional common currency. What happened to it that will lead a neighboring Gambia to have this dispute? And do you think these leaders will be able to resolve it amicably?
It's not going to be a very easy. It's not going to be a very. They will not going to find a very easy common ground to resolve this amicably, because there are other local protocols that were signed between, you know, neighbors, like, for instance, Senegal, Guinea-Conakry, or Senegal, Mali. But we all have sometimes some of, because most of these countries, trade unions, they all sometimes, you know, I mean, break these protocols. So it's not going to be easy. But this time around, although the Gambia's health state is not around, but they said that certainly this will also be an avenue where they will try to resolve this, especially in the case of Senegal and Gambia. They are, you know, next door neighbors, but they always have this border problem. This is the sixth border closed since 2005.
Alpha Jallo is an independent Senegalese journalist. He spoke with me from the capital, Dakar. The Angolan main opposition party, UNITA, has sharply condemned President José Eduardo dos Santos's appointment of his daughter, Isabel dos Santos, as the new head of the state oil company Sonangol. This after President dos Santos fired all board members of Sonangol in April. Isabel dos Santos, who described herself as a self-made billionaire, is currently Africa's richest woman with an estimated worth of $3.3 billion, according to US-based Forbes magazine. But UNITA spokesman Alcide Sakala told me the appointment of Isabel dos Santos is yet another demonstration of favoritism and graft perpetuated by the ruling Movement for the Liberation of Angola, or MPLA.
It is not a surprise for us, because the lady was recently appointed by his father as a person who will be restructuring the oil company. And I think what with this appointment, it not has come as a surprise. It was something expected. So it confirms what we have been saying, the politics of nepotism in our country.
Supporters of the administration and the ruling party are saying that she has the private sector business competence, and that she's experienced in the private sector, and that is why she is most qualified to restructure Sonangol. Why do you doubt that?
First of all, she's a daughter of the president, you know. So the president, I think, is trying to have all his sons and relatives having an important role on the management of the wealth of the country. Isabel is now on the oil sector. His son is dealing with the sovereign fund, as you can see. And all his friends now are part of this process, which is making a small group of Angolans very, very, very rich. It is a politics that UNITA has been denounced for the past years, and also international reports. Most of them, they are focused also on this particular issue.
Some supporters are saying that the fact that she is the daughter of the president, or the fact that the father has children who are competent, does not preclude them from being appointed into positions that they are qualified for. First, they are also Angolans. His supporters are saying this is just jealousy, and that opposition like yours, UNITA, are just criticizing for the sake of criticisms.
Well, it is not jealous. I think, you know, there is a conflict of interests. Can you see, as a member of parliament, for instance, in Angola, you cannot take business because you are a member of parliament. But if you are a son or a daughter of the president, You know, you can have the most of the health of the country. I think the ethic point of view is wrong. And also it is against the probation law, which has been adopted some years ago in our country. That's why we, as UNITA, we are going to analyze it at the light of the Angolan law, and we are going to take a position on that. I think it is not correct, you as a president, to have only your family dealing with public money for the benefit of the family. You understand my point?
Some UNITA supporters have condemned the latest appointment, but they've also said that leadership of the party should take this matter to court because it's against the constitution and it's nepotism and all that you have said. Is the executive of UNITA going to adhere to what your supporters are calling for?
Well, there are so many points of view within the party. The leadership is going to take them into account. We're going to make an assessment as far as all these points of views are concerned, and we're going to take a position on that. But it is true, nobody agrees with that. Because you, as the president, you cannot have your family, you know, dealing with this health for the benefit of your own family. When you look at the country where poverty is really a problem, is a national problem in our country, people are starving, people are facing a lot of difficulties, and you take your family as managers for the health of the country.
Aside Sakala is the spokesman for the Angolan main opposition UNITA. He spoke with me from the capital, Luanda. A jury has found three Minneapolis men guilty of trying to join ISIS. They were convicted by a federal jury Friday afternoon of conspiring to commit murder in Syria on behalf of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, and to provide material support to the designated foreign terrorist organization. They face up to life in jail. Abdi Rizak Bihe is a social activist and director of the Somali Education and Social Advocacy Center. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in Minneapolis for his reaction to the convictions.
Just like many members of the community, we were not surprised that the verdict turned out this way.
Why? Why were we surprised?
We thought that there were a lot of evidences against this young man.
How would you react to those protesters we had who had posters saying that stop FBI entrapment and stop targeting Somalis? What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, everyone has a different opinion and perspective, and I think they had their own perspectives.
This investigation dates back to almost more than 6 years ago, when nearly two dozen young Minnesotans left to join the Somali group Al-Shabaab. How serious is that problem? Is that serious problem now in Minnesota?
Well, that was about more than 6 years ago. It was 2008, November, when we spoke out. But the problem was going on for 10 years, since 2006. And my own nephew was one of them in 2008, November. I don't think the problem is the same. I think things are getting much better. We have noticed that there's a huge difference between when kids were being radicalized for Al-Shabaab and now for Syria. The community felt that for Al-Shabaab, some members of the community think that at least the kids had connection in Somalia, or some young men were being radicalized Al-Shabaab because of the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia. But right now, for Syria, things are different. The community cannot comprehend why these young men are going to Syria. And they cannot find any justification. So it feels like there's no discussion in the community about this, except the anger, why Syria?
Why do you think these, because generally most of them are young men, do you think they lack a sense of community in Minnesota? What do you think drives them to look for these kind of hotspots?
For the past 8 years, we have been very loud saying what the causes are. Unfortunately, we haven't had any listening ears except recently. The conditions in the community, the socio-economic conditions of the community, needs to be addressed. 60% of the Somali American community in Minnesota are under the federal poverty guidelines. Close to 35% are unemployed. 40% of our adults are unemployed. Our average age in the community is 20 years. We are more than 100,000, contrary to the official number of 30 or 40,000. So those conditions must be addressed. Our young men who are graduating from public schools in high school are 40%. So those conditions must be looked at. Unemployment, lack of youth programming, all those things are a big part of these problems. And the problems we have is not really isolated to radicalization. It's about incarceration, violence, and many other issues.
Abdirizak Bihi is a social activist and director of the Somali Education and Social Advocacy Center. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impoga from Minneapolis. Atrocities perpetrated by jihadists, including the so-called Islamic State in the Middle East, Al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa, and Boko Haram in West Africa, have been fueling anti-Muslim sentiment and religious discrimination around the world. In Cameroon, Muslim authorities are currently fleshing out strategies to shake off stigmatization and check budding Islamophobia. Among them is a plan to set up an institution to arm spiritual guides with the doctrine of moderate Islam. For VOA, Intarieke Divine Junior has more from the Cameroonian commercial capital, Douala.
Up until 2013, Muslims in Cameroon proclaimed and practiced their faith freely. That changed when the Nigerian homegrown militant group Boko Haram decided to target West Africa in a crusade to create a caliphate across the Lake Chad Basin area. Now, Cameroonian Muslims are being tossed into the black books. According to government officials, Cameroon is a secular state in which Christians make up 63% of its over 22 million inhabitants. 22% are Muslim, while the remaining 15% clings to traditional beliefs or atheism. But amid the global rise in terror and Boko Haram havoc in Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, the peaceful religious coexistence previously enjoyed by Cameroon appears to be in jeopardy.
Donc il y a l'ignorance, il y a une confusion déjà. D'autres identifient l'islam par rapport à la violence. Or,
El Hadj Oman Jimouni is president of the Islamic Cultural Association in the capital Yaoundé. He says increasingly, many Cameroonians are linking Islam to terror. As a result, he adds, there's been a sharp rise in Islamophobia, with Muslims often stigmatized and deemed potential terrorists.
Oh, people of Cameroon, know that a man can't be a Muslim without rebelling against democracy. Your troops are nothing. Even Nigerian soldiers couldn't do anything to us. Even US troops couldn't do anything to us. Not even the troops of the whole world.
Led by the incendiary rhetoric of Abubakar Shekau, Boko Haram is generally considered a byproduct of radical Islam across Cameroon. In recent months, the extremist group is blamed for turning hundreds of young people across predominantly Muslim northern Cameroon into jihadists. Suicide bombings, kidnappings, devastation of entire villages and farmlands, cattle rustling, and the uprooting of hundreds of thousands of people from their homes have become daily occurrences in northern Cameroon. In response, security forces have been arresting Muslim religious and traditional rulers, as well as their subjects suspected of collusion with Boko Haram or the propagation of radical ideology. Scores of Quranic teaching centers have been sealed and the wearing of face veils or burqas banned. Meantime, the government is stepping up public infrastructure investments in the north as a way to diffuse the appeal of extremists. Reforms include getting more children into schools and lifting young people out of poverty through financial assistance for business startups. They will also include ensuring adequate supplies of basic necessities, including clean drinking water, electricity, and health care. Reporting for VOA News, I'm Tariq Divine Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
Some Zimbabweans are reportedly hoarding basic commodities in anticipation of a food crisis as a result of the liquidity crunch prevailing in the country. This has resulted in restrictions in purchasing basic commodities in the country. For VOA reporter Thomas Chiripazi has details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The unavailability of ready cash in local banks has forced some Harare residents to start buying basic commodities in bulk in anticipation of a food crisis. One such skeptical consumer is Maybelline resident Rosemary Chinyadza, who said the current cash crisis might result in serious food shortages, almost like what Zimbabweans witnessed at the height of the nation's economic recession between 2007 and 2008.
We're just buying goods because we don't know what will happen to us because of the bond notes crisis.
The bulk purchasing of basic commodities has forced some shops to start limiting the purchasing of certain commodities. For example, a retail shop in Harare Central Business District was today limiting the purchasing of a 2-liter cooking oil bottle to one bottle per customer. Several shop owners in Harare say they are witnessing panic buying of basic commodities, with some customers expressing dismay over the current cash crisis, which has resulted in most of them spending a lot of time in bank queues. The situation is being worsened by the central bank's moves to introduce bond notes. Linda Masarirambi, who works for a local company that operates from the city's central business district, said instead of concentrating on her job, she is now spending most of her time in bank queues looking for cash. Masarirambi said she is unable to feed her family due to lack of cash to buy basic commodities.
The issue of this cash crisis in Zimbabwe is very, very, very troublesome. We don't even know how we are going to survive in Zimbabwe. We are forced to queue for long hours in order for me to obtain my hard-earned cash. And moreover, I'm being given $50, $50 full of coins. From that $50, I'm supposed to pay rent, I'm supposed to pay fees, I'm supposed to buy food for the kids, I'm supposed to obtain my transport money in order for me to go back to work.
Gibson Zindove, who runs a car repair business in Avondale, said he is no longer depositing money in banks because it would be difficult for him to access it when he wants to finance his business operations.
We no longer have confidence in the banks because there are charges always. When you deposit the money, there are charges accrued. When you withdraw the money, there are also charges accrued. So we no longer have trust and confidence in the banks. And with the coming of bond notes, no one will ever put his money or her money in a bank because no one wants to change US dollar with the bond notes, which is fake money.
Reacting to the questions on panic buying and cash shortages, Love Moka Denge, president of the Zimbabwe Economic Society, said failure by most companies to access cash from banks was affecting the national economy.
Already our economy is not performing. We are encouraging local production. But local companies are also complaining because I believe there is a priority list from the Reserve Bank if you want to import raw material from South Africa or another country.
Kadenge urged Zimbabwean authorities to come up with policies that would restore confidence in the financial services sector and stop panic buying of basic commodities. From Harare, This is Thomas Chiripasi.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, and coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Muhammad Ali, the self-described greatest of all time, died late Friday at a hospital in Phoenix, Arizona, surrounded by his family after spending the last few days receiving treatment for respiratory complications. For more, Ni Akwete, a policy analyst, activist, and a boxing enthusiast, joins us live via telephone link up to talk about what he remembers about the greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali. Good afternoon, Ni.
Good afternoon, Peter. Thanks for having me on your program.
You're welcome. How is your day so far, and what do you remember about the greatest man of boxing?
Well, you know, I'm of a certain age, so growing up in Accra, the thing that I remember the most is when Muhammad Ali visited Ghana in May of 1964.
Yes.
In fact, Osagyefo invited him, and he spent 2 weeks in Ghana, longer than any other African country that he went to, Nigeria and Egypt. And there were some, he cut short his visit, so some countries he didn't go, including some in Asia and other places. So he spent a lot of time in Ghana, particularly in Accra and in Kumasi, where he even tried to, he tested his strength on the Okonfo Anochi's sword. He had boxing exhibition with his brother, Rahman, with whom he came. The president, President Nkrumah, gave him a copy of his book, Africa Must Unite. And so you can pinpoint the date, May 18, 1964. In fact, the book wound up in Cairo. It was recently found by an intellectual, a British intellectual in Cairo, who bought it and has hold of it. He, Muhammad Ali also, the president gave him some talking drums and a whole bunch of things. And of course, when they did his the movie about him with Will Smith, the Ghana visit was so important that they actually shot a portion of the film in Accra, in Ghana. I have relatives who were among the extras in that film. Of course, young people, they weren't born when he was there, but when the film was done, they were the extras. So I remember personally his visit to Accra and Kumasi and how much it churned the country. But, of course, you cannot forget that he was such a boxing legend. So even before he came to Ghana, he hit the news when he won the championship, the gold medal at the Rome Olympics in 1960, when he was only 18. And then, of course, he went on and defeated Sonny Liston and became the heavyweight champion.
Let me ask you this. What do you think he meant for Africans and for black people in general?
I think he was huge. I mean, you need a new word to describe how important he was. Of course, when his death was announced last night and this morning, you go back to trying to remember things and reading things, so you are learning a whole lot. He was very important to African Americans here, because he spoke up against not wanting to go to Vietnam and saying, you know, the Viet Cong never called him the N-word. And people like Julian Bond and even others who were uncomfortable because they thought his stance was too radical, they very much admired him. Julian Bond said this. Dr. King sent him a note. So for African Americans, he was huge because Not only was he a great boxer, but he had the courage of an activist. Of course, being an activist, I want to wrap myself in what he did. So in the U.S., he was great. But I'm telling you, he was even bigger in Africa. This is what I mean. I mean, the gentleman who has the book that President Nkrumah gave to Muhammad Ali, he has just written the London Review of Books saying that Ghana was the place to go if you were a black activist anywhere in the world. You went to Ghana. A lot of prominent African-Americans lived there. And as I'm saying, he also, this was 1964, just when the OAU was being formed. He went to Nigeria from Ghana and then went to Egypt and spent a little longer time there than he did in Nigeria. So for he was a huge symbol for black people everywhere, but particularly for the founders of the African, the OAU, Africa's liberators, the founding fathers who were then pushing to unite Africa, and also the non-aligned movement where they were saying, look, imperialism and colonialism were used to colonize us, and therefore we want to stay neutral. I mean, these were important times in global history, and he was a very big symbol. So he was incredibly important for black people in the United States, in the rest of the diaspora, and particularly in the home continent. And by the way, Muhammad Ali himself, when he got to Ghana and then returned to the U.S., he said this was a trip to the fatherland.
Now, Neil, let me ask you this, and briefly. Do you think he was an effective civil rights activist and who was able to transcend boxing and become a global icon?
No question about that. I mean, all you have to do is compare him with some of the latter-day, athletes, famous athletes in this country and elsewhere. A lot of people, when they become famous, whether musicians or athletes, don't want to jeopardize their fame. They will even tell you, well, people of all color buy my records or watch me, so I'm not going to risk that. He did risk that. So he was, he had so many gifts. He was extremely courageous, and yes, he was a huge and effective in his time. I mean, I can't think of anybody more effective than me. Of course, I mean, you have the Dr. Kings and others, but this was an athlete. This was a boxer, okay, who didn't have a lot of formal education. But you could tell he was brilliant. He had a brilliant mind. He had a great insight. And so the answer is unquestionably he's one of the, not just beyond boxing, he was a hugely important and effective civil rights leader and advocate for the rights of black people and for the rights of everybody.
Thank you very much. Ni Akwete is a policy analyst, activist, and a boxing enthusiast. He joined us live. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Give it to me. Hey, 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 hey babu, organic babu, 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 babu,
Come on to Tampa, show my bear one day go. danser avec moi. Vous dansez avec moi.
I say you like Lukumba. Oh yeah, that's I'm like a willow Lukumba. I know say you like Lukumba. Oh yeah, that's I'm like a willow Lukumba. Hey, in love, cause she got me falling in love. Oh, hey. Fighting karate, yeah, I bought in a Bugatti, yeah, I go buy you Ferrari, you don't get any choice but to marry, yeah, I don't give you the khaki, yeah, you be calling me daddy, Khadija, señorita, bonita, mamacita, Aisha, señorita, Aisha, bossita. Karate, eh, hey, I'm holding a Bugatti, eh, hey, I go buy you Ferrari, you don't get any choice but to marry, eh, hey, I go give you the khaki, eh, hey, you be calling me daddy. Your lover, baby, please give me. Oh. I'm going crazy. Oh, let me be your maga. Your maga. I want to be your maga. Your lover,
tell me what you want. Oh, 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 hey. I just wanna know your need.
Cause the way you dey touch the body, I like the way you dey do the body. Body make me want to dey gummy body, dey gummy body.
Ha, okay.
Eh? Oh yeah, the popo.
Baby, make me go the popo.
Ah.
Oh yeah, the popo.
Eh?
Baby, make me go the popo. Oh, she go the popo. So make me go the popo.
Oh yeah, tonight. Oh tonight. Oh. Baby, please give me. I want to be your maga, your lover. Baby, please give me. I'm going crazy. Oh, let me be your maga, your maga. I want to be your maga, your lover.
There is something about this, your body, where they make me the jolly. When I see you, my baby, I just like you happy. Oh, 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 my baby. You dey sweep me up, oh oh, my baby. Tonight, oh yeah, limpo,
eh? Baby, make me go limpo,
what?
Oh yeah, limpo, baby, make me go limpo,
okay.
Oh, she go limpo,
eh?
So make me go limpo,
oh yeah. Tonight, oh tonight, oh. Baby, please give me.
Tonight,
I'm going crazy.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Mark Ferguson, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, we mustn't confuse mastery with mimicry, knowledge with superstitious ignorance. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
This month, Americans will complete an important part of the process of selecting the candidates for which they will vote in November for the office of President of the United States. The two major political parties in America, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, will hold the last of the statewide political primary elections or caucuses in which voters in those states choose delegates to the national conventions of those parties. The delegates, in turn, will choose their party's candidate for president. The framers of the Constitution of the United States disliked and distrusted political parties. In a famous treatise on government, James Madison, one of the framers of the Constitution and later President of the United States, warned that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties. The Constitution makes no mention of parties, but instead provides for the president to be chosen by electors from each state, constituting what is called the Electoral College. In the first two presidential elections, George Washington was nominated and elected by the Electoral College. But by 1796, political parties had emerged, and party caucuses within the U.S. Congress and the state legislatures selected the candidates for which the Electoral College would vote. The party caucus system gave way in 1832 to the National Party Convention, usually made up of delegates selected by the party conventions in the various states. The party convention system was dominated by party leaders and political bosses, a process lacking in transparency and often taking little account of the wishes of the voters. In 1901, Florida became the first state to hold a presidential primary to select delegates to a national convention. In the decades that followed, more and more states moved toward a primary election system, which diminished the role of party leaders and empowered voters to choose the candidates. By 1992, Democrats had primaries in 40 states and Republicans in 39. Today, primaries are conducted by state and local governments. Caucuses are conducted by party officials. Some states have primaries, others have caucuses or a combination of both. The primary system, like democracy itself, has its flaws and is faced with many challenges. But in the U.S., it is, in the main, ordinary voters, not party leaders or government officials, who choose the candidates for America's highest office.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.